Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to go back to Saki and the novel The Unbearable Bassington, and we left it off at the end of Chapter 10. Comus had just discovered that his rival and his friend slash sort of mentor, Courtney Ugel, was engaged to the girl he was after himself, Elaine DeFry. He had wanted to give him a loan, which decided her upon opting for the slightly older and richer and better status man. So we'll do today chapter 11 and 12. After the momentous lunch at the corridor restaurant, Elaine DeFry had returned to Manchester Square, where she was staying with one of her numerous aunts, in a frame of mind that embraced a tangle of competing emotions. In the first place, she was conscious of a dominant feeling of relief. In a moment of impetuosity, not wholly influenced by pique — the pique was over him asking, Comus asking her for a loan. But the author says not wholly influenced by pique, but that was part of it. Her irritation at one of the rivals led her to take the other suitor. She had settled the problem which hours of hard thinking and serious heart searching had brought to no nearer to solution. And although she felt just a little inclined to be scared at the headlong manner of her final decision, she had now very little doubt in her own mind that the decision had been the right one. In fact, the wonder seemed rather that she should have been so long in doubt as to which of her wooers really enjoyed her honest approval. She had been in love these many weeks past with an imaginary Comus, but now she had definitely walked out of her dreamland. But now that she had definitely walked out of her dreamland, she saw that nearly all the qualities that had appealed to her on his behalf had been absent from, or only fitfully present in, the character of the real Comus. So Comus that she liked was basically a figure of her imagination, not the real thing. And the reality was obnoxious enough that eventually she allowed it to pierce her veil of illusion. And now that she had installed Ugel in the first place of her affections, he had rapidly acquired in her eyes some of the qualities which ranked highest in her estimation. Like the proverbial buyer, she had the happy feminine tendency of magnifying the worth of her possession as soon as she had acquired it. And Courtney Ugel gave Elaine some justification for her sense of having chosen wisely. Above all other things, selfish and cynical though he might appear at times, he was unfailingly courteous and considerate towards her. That was a circumstance which would always have carried weight with her in judging any man. In this case, its value was enormously heightened by contrast with the behavior of her other wooer, i.e. the guy, the cad, the callow youth asking her for a loan repeatedly and not paying it back. And Ugel had, in her eyes, the advantage of the glamour of combat. Even the combat of words and wire pulling throws over the fighter, or the advantage that combat throws over the fighter. He stood well in the forefront of a battle which, however carefully stage managed, however honeycombed with personal insincerities and overlaid with calculated mock heroics, really meant something, really counted for good or wrong in the nation's development and the world's history. Shrewd parliamentary observers might have warned her that Ugel would never stand much higher in the political world than he did at present. As a brilliant opposition freelance, leading lively and rather meaningless forays against the dull and rather purposeless foreign policy of a government that was scarcely either to be blamed or congratulated on its handling of foreign affairs, the young politician had not the strength of character or convictions that keeps a man naturally in the forefront of affairs and gives his counsels a sterling value. And on the other hand, his insincerity was not deep enough to allow him to pose artificially and successfully as a leader of men and shaper of movements. For the moment, however, his place in public life was sufficiently marked out to give him a secure footing in that world where people are counted individually and not in herds. The woman whom he would make his wife would have the chance, too, if she had the will and the skill, to become an individual who counted. There was balm to Elaine in this reflection, yet it did not wholly suffice to drive out the feeling of pique which Comus had called into being by his slighting view of her as a convenient cash supply in moments of emergency. She found a certain satisfaction in scrupulously observing her promise, made earlier on that eventful day, and sent off a messenger with the stipulated loan, I think it was £2. Then a reaction of compunction set in, and she reminded herself that in fairness she ought to write and tell her news in as friendly a fashion as possible to her dismissed suitor before it burst upon him from some other quarter. Of course it already has. They parted on more or less quarreling terms, it was true, but neither of them had foreseen the finality of the parting, nor the permanence of the breach between them. Comus might even now be thinking himself half forgiven, and the awakening would be rather cruel. The letter, however, did not prove an easy one to write. Not only did it present difficulties of its own, but it suffered from the competing urgency of a desire to be doing something far pleasanter than writing explanatory and valedictory phrases. Elaine was possessed with an unusual but quite overmastering hankering to visit her cousin Suzette Brankley. They met, but rarely at each other's houses and very seldom anywhere else, and Elaine, for her part, was never conscious of feeling that their opportunities for intercourse lacked anything in the way of adequacy. Suzette accorded her just that touch of patronage which a moderately well-off and immoderately dull girl will usually try to mete out to an acquaintance who is known to be wealthy and suspected of possessing brains. In return, Elaine armed herself with that particular brand of mock humility which can be so terribly disconcerting if properly wielded. No quarrel of any description stood between them, and one could not legitimately have described them as enemies, but they never disarmed in one another's presence. A misfortune of any magnitude falling on one of them would have been sincerely regretted by the other, but any minor discomfiture would have produced a feeling very much akin to satisfaction. That's Schadenfreude. Human nature knows millions of these inconsequent little feuds, springing up and flourishing apart from any basis of racial, political, religious, or economic causes, as a hint perhaps to crass, unseeing altruists that enmity has its place and purpose in the world, as well as benevolence. Elaine had not personally congratulated Suzette since the formal announcement of her engagement to the young man with the dissentient tailoring effects. The impulse to go and do so now overmastered her sense of what was due to Comus in the way of explanation. And you see, pause right there. Note people right then thought about what they owed others. They didn't think about their rights as they do nowadays to the exclusion of all else. They thought first of what they owed other people and the community at large. Another difference. Were they more civilized then than now? Unmistakably and certainly they were. The letter was still in its blank, unwritten stage, an unmarshaled sequence of sentences forming in her brain when she ordered her car and made a hurried but well-thought-out change into her most sumptuously sober afternoon toilet. Suzette, she felt tolerably sure, would still be in the costume that she had worn in the park that morning, a costume that aimed at an elaboration of detail and was damned with overmuch success. Suzette's mother welcomed her unexpected visitor with an obvious satisfaction. Her daughter's engagement, she explained, was not so brilliant from the social point of view as a girl of Suzette's attractions and advantages might have legitimately aspired to, but Egbert, no kidding, Egbert, was a thoroughly commendable and dependable young man who would very probably win his way before long to membership of the county council. From there, of course, the road would be open to him to higher things, she said. Yes, said Elaine, he might become an alderman. Have you seen their photographs taken together? Asked Mrs. Brankley, abandoning the subject of Egbert's prospective career. No, do show me, said Elaine, with a flattering show of interest. I've never seen that sort of thing before. It used to be the fashion once for engaged couples to be photographed together, didn't it? It's very much the fashion now, said Mrs. Brankley assertively, but some of the complacency had filtered out of her voice. Suzette came into the room wearing the dress that she had worn in the park that morning. Of course, you've been hearing about the engagement from Mother, she cried, and then set to work conscientiously to cover the same ground. We met at Grindelwald, you know. He always calls me his Ice Maiden because we first got to know each other in the skating rink. Quite romantic, wasn't it? Then we asked him to tea one day and we got to be quite friendly. Then he proposed. He wasn't the only one who was smitten with Suzette, Mrs. Brankley hastened to put in, fearful lest Elaine might suppose that Egbert had things all his own way. There was an American millionaire who was quite taken with her, and a Polish count of a very old family. I assure you, I felt quite nervous at some of our tea parties. Mrs. Brankley had given Grindelwald a sinister but rather alluring reputation among a large circle of untraveled friends as a place where the insolence of birth and wealth was held in precarious check from breaking forth into scenes of savage violence. My marriage with Egbert will, of course, enlarge the sphere of my life tremendously, or enormously, pursued Suzette. This is how you set yourself up when you brag, especially when you don't know why an unexpected guest who you see rarely has showed up on your doorstep. Yes, said Elaine. Her eyes were rather remorselessly taking in the details of her cousin's toilet. It is said that nothing is sadder than victory except defeat. Suzette began to feel that the tragedy of both was concentrated in the creation which had given her such unalloyed gratification till Elaine had come on the scene. A woman can be so immensely helpful in the social way to a man who is making a career for himself, and I'm so glad to find that we've a great many ideas in common. We each made out a list of our idea of the 100 best books, and quite a number of them were the same. He looks bookish, said Elaine, with a critical glance at the photograph. Oh, he's not at all a bookworm, said Suzette quickly, though he's tremendously well-read. He's quite the man of action. Does he hunt? Asked Elaine. No, he doesn't get much time or opportunity for writing. What a pity, commented Elaine. I don't think I could marry a man who wasn't fond of writing. Of course, that's a matter of taste, said Suzette stiffly. Horsey men are not usually gifted with overmuch brains, are they? Remember, Courtney rides a horse. There is as much difference between a horseman and a horsey man as there is between a well-dressed man and a dressy one, said Elaine judicially. And you may have noticed how seldom a dressy woman really knows how to dress. As an old lady of my acquaintance observed the other day, some people are born with a sense of how to clothe themselves, others acquire it, others look as if their clothes have been thrust upon them, which is a twisted witticism. She gave Lady Caroline, who has all the lines, her due quotation marks, but the sudden tactfulness with which she looked away from her cousin's frock was entirely her own idea. So again, these women are... Mencken said, and maybe he got it from Saki or Schopenhauer or Twain, or he said women always greet each other as if they're diplomats from hostile countries. Very polite, but it's all guarded hostility, veiled hostility. A young man entering the room at this moment caused a diversion that was rather welcome to Suzette. Here comes Egbert, she announced, with an air of subdued triumph. It was at least a satisfaction to be able to produce the captive of her charms, alive and in good condition, on the scene. Elaine might be as critical as she pleased, but a live lover outweighed any number of well-dressed, straight-riding cavaliers who existed only as distant vision of the delectable husband. Egbert was one of those men who have no small talk, but possess an inexhaustible supply of the larger variety. In whatever society he happened to be, and particularly in the immediate neighborhood of an afternoon tea table with a limited audience of women folk, he gave the impression of someone who was addressing a public meeting and would be happy to answer questions afterwards. A suggestion of gaslit mission halls, wet umbrellas, and discreet applause seemed to accompany him everywhere. He was an exponent, among other things, of what he called New Thought, capital N-T, which seemed to lend itself conveniently to the employment of a good deal of rather stale phraseology. Probably in the course of some 30-odd years of existence, he had never been of any notable use to any man, to man, woman, child, or animal, but it was his firmly announced intention to leave the world a better, happier, purer place than he had found it, against the danger of any relapse to earlier conditions after his disappearance from the scene, he was, of course, powerless to guard. 'Tis not in mortals to ensure succession, and Egbert was admittedly mortal. Elaine found him immensely entertaining and would certainly have exerted herself to draw him out if such a proceeding had been at all necessary. She listened to his conversation with the complacent appreciation that one bestows on a stage tragedy from whose calamities one can escape at any moment by the simple process of leaving one's seat. When at last he checked the flow of his opinions by a hurried reference to his watch and declared that he must be moving on elsewhere, Elaine almost expected a vote of thanks to be accorded him, or to be asked to signify herself in favor of some resolution by holding up her hand. When the young man had bidden the company a rapid, businesslike farewell, tempered in Suzette's case by the exact degree of tender intimacy that it would have been considered improper to omit or overstep, Elaine turned to her expectant cousin with an air of cordial congratulation. "He is exactly the husband I should have chosen for you, Suzette." Which is an insult veiled as a compliment. For the second time that afternoon, Suzette felt a sense of waning enthusiasm for one of her possessions. Mrs. Brankley detected the note of ironical congratulation in her visitor's verdict. "I suppose she means he's not her idea of a husband, but he's good enough for Suzette," she observed to herself, with a snort that expressed itself somewhere in the nostrils of the brain. Then, with a smiling air of heavy patronage, she delivered herself of one idea of a damaging counterstroke. "And when are we to hear of your engagement, my dear?" "Now," said Elaine quietly, but with electrical effect. "I came to announce it to you, but I wanted to hear all about Suzette first. It will be formally announced in the papers in a day or two." "But who is it? Is it the young man who was with you in the park this morning?" asked Suzette. "Let me see, who was I with in the park this morning? A very good-looking dark boy? Oh no, not Comus Bassington. Someone you know by name, anyway, and I expect you've seen his portrait in the papers." "A flying man?" asked Mrs. Brankley. "Courtenay Ugel," said Elaine. Mrs. Brankley and Suzette had often rehearsed in the privacy of their minds the occasion when Elaine should come to pay her personal congratulations to her engaged cousin. It had never been in the least like this. On her return from her enjoyable afternoon visit, Elaine found an express messenger letter waiting for her. It was from Comus, thanking her for the loan and returning it. "I suppose I ought never to have asked you for it," he wrote, "but you were always so deliciously solemn about money matters. That I couldn't resist. Just heard the news of your engagement to Courtenay. Congrats to you both. I'm far too stony broke to buy you a wedding present, so I'm going to give you back the bread and butter dish. Luckily, it still has your crest on it. I shall love to think of you and Courtenay eating bread and butter out of it for the rest of your lives." It's kind of funny. That was all he had to say on the matter, about which Elaine had been preparing to write a long and kindly expressed letter, closing a rather momentous chapter in her life and his. There was not a trace of regret or upbraiding in his notice, in his note. He had walked out of their mutual fairyland as abruptly as she had, and to all appearances far more unconcernedly. Reading the letter again and again, Elaine could come to no decision as to whether this was merely a courageous jibe at defeat, or whether it represented the real value that Comus set on the thing that he had lost. And she would never know. If Comus possessed one useless gift of perfection, it was the gift of laughing at fate, even when it had struck him hardest. One day, perhaps, the laughter and mockery would be silent on his lips, and fate would have the advantage of laughing last. But not that day. That's chapter 11, and now we'll do chapter 12. to complete today's duet. 12. A door closed, and Francesca Bassington sat alone in her well-beloved drawing room. The visitor, who had been enjoying the hospitality of her afternoon tea table, had just taken his departure. The tête-à-tête had not been a pleasant one, at any rate as far as Francesca was concerned, but at least it had brought her the information for which she had been seeking. Her role of looker-on from a tactful distance had necessarily left her much in the dark concerning the progress of the all-important wooing, but during the last few hours she had, on slender though significant evidence, exchanged her complacent expectancy for a conviction that something had gone wrong. She had spent the previous evening at her brother's house and had naturally seen nothing of Comus in that uncongenial quarter. Neither had he put in an appearance at the breakfast table the following morning. She had met him in the hall at 11 o'clock, and he had hurried past her, merely imparting the information that he would not be until dinner that evening. He spoke in his sulkiest tone, and his face wore a look of defeat, thinly masked by an air of defiance. It was not the defiance of a man who was losing, but of one who was already lost. So that's a hint to his real feelings about what transpired. Francesca's conviction that things had gone wrong between Comus and Elaine Defry grew in strength as the day wore on. She lunched at a friend's house, but it was not a quarter where special social information of any importance was likely to come early to hand. Instead of the news she was hankering for, she had to listen to trivial gossip and speculation on the flirtations and cases and affairs of a string of acquaintances whose matrimonial projects interested her about as much as the nesting arrangements of the wildfowl in St. James's Park. She only cares about one thing, and she doesn't even care about that for its own sake. She cares about it for her sake. "Of course," said her hostess, with the duly impressive emphasis of a privileged chronicler, "we've always regarded Claire as the marrying one of the family, so when Emily came to us and said, 'I've got some news for you,' we all said, 'Claire's engaged.' 'Oh no,' said Emily, 'it's not Claire this time. It's me! Yeah!' So then we had to guess who the lucky man was. 'It can't be Captain Parmenter,' we all said, 'because he's always been sweet on Joan.' And then Emily said," the recording voice reeled off the catalog of inane remarks with a comfortable purring complacency that held out no hope of an early abandoning of the topic. Francesca sat and wondered why the innocent acceptance of a cutlet and a glass of indifferent claret should lay one open to such unsparing punishment. A stroll homeward through the park after lunch brought no further enlightenment on the subject that was uppermost in her mind. What was worse, it brought her, without possibility of escape, within hailing distance of Merla Blathlington, who fastened onto her with the enthusiasm of a lonely tsetse fly encountering an outpost of civilization. Those are the tsetse flies, or the African flies that have the sleeping sickness and that cause the blindness. Of course, the blacks can't do the science to figure any of that out. They just suffer from the flies until the white man shows up and solves the problem. "Just think," she buzzed inconsequently, "my sister in Cambridgeshire has hatched out 33 white Orpington chickens in her incubator." "What eggs did she put in?" asked Francesca. "Oh, some very special strain of white Orpington." Totally missing the dig. "Then I don't see anything remarkable in the result. If she had put in crocodile's eggs and hatched out white Orpingtons, there might have been something to write to Country Life about. What funny, fascinating things these little green park chairs are," said Merla, starting off on a fresh topic. "They always look so quaint and knowing when they're stuck away in pairs by themselves under the trees, as if they were having a heart-to-heart talk or discussing a piece of very private scandal. If they could only speak, what tragedies and comedies they could tell us of, what flirtations and proposals." "Let us be devoutly thankful that they can't," said Francesca, with a shuddering recollection of the luncheon table conversation. "Of course, it would make one very careful what one said before them, or above them, rather," Merla rattled on, and then, to Francesca's infinite relief, she espied another acquaintance sitting in an unprotected solitude who promised to supply a more durable audience than her presently rapidly moving companion. Francesca was free to return to her drawing room in Blue Street to await with such patience as she could command the coming of some visitor who might be able to throw light on the subject that was puzzling and disquieting her. The arrival of George St. Michael boded bad news, but at any rate, she gave him an almost cordial welcome.
"Well, you see, I wasn't far wrong about Mr. Fry at Courtney Ugel, was I?" he chirruped, almost before he had seated himself.
Francesca was to be spared any further spinning out of her period of uncertainty.
"Yes, it's officially given out," he went on, "and it's to appear in the Morning Post tomorrow. I heard it from Colonel Deal this morning, and he had it direct from Ugel himself."
"Yes, please, one lump. I'm not fashionable, you see."
He had made the same remark about the sugar in his tea with unfailing regularity for at least 30 years, and that's no freaking joke.
That's no joke. People who find a joke funny once, it's kind of the white man. The black will say things 15 times in a row in the same minute, and the white man will extend that over 15 years, thinking the same joke is funny forever. Very few jokes are funny forever.
Fashions in sugar are apparently stationary.
"They say," he continued hurriedly, "that he proposed to her on the terrace of the house, and a division bell rang, and he had to hurry off before she had time to give her answer, and when he got back, she simply stated, 'The eyes have it.'"
St. Michael paused in his narrative to give an appreciative giggle, so he just made that garbage up.
"Just the sort of inanity that would go the rounds," remarked Francesca, with the satisfaction of knowing that she was making the criticism direct to the author and begetter of the inanity in question. Now that the blow had fallen and she knew the full extent of its weight, her feelings toward the bringer of bad news, who sat complacently nibbling at her tea cakes and scattering crumbs of tiresome small talk at her feet, was one of wholehearted dislike. She could sympathize with, or at any rate understand, the tendency of Oriental despots to inflict death or ignominious chastisement on messengers bearing tidings of misfortune and defeat. And St. Michael, she perfectly well knew, was thoroughly aware of the fact that her hopes and wishes had been centered on the possibility of having Elaine for a daughter-in-law. Every purring remark that his mean little soul prompted him to contribute to the conversation had an easily recognizable undercurrent of malice. Fortunately for her powers of endurance, which had been put to such searching and repeated tests that day, St. Michael had planned out for himself a busy little timetable of afternoon visits, at each of which his self-appointed task of forestalling and embellishing the newspaper announcements of the Ugel de Fry engagement would be hurriedly but thoroughly performed.
"They'll be quite one of the best-looking and most interesting couples of the season, won't they?" he cried by way of farewell. The door closed, and Francesca Baskington sat alone in her drawing room. Before she could give way to the bitter luxury of reflection on the downfall of her hopes, it was prudent to take precautionary measures against unwelcome intrusions. Summoning the maid, who had just speeded the departing of St. Michael, she gave the order, "I am not at home this afternoon," to Lady Caroline Benaresque. On second thoughts, she extended the taboo to all possible callers and sent a telephone message to catch Comus at his club, asking him to come and see her as soon as he could manage it before it was time to dress for dinner. Then she sat down to think, and her thinking was beyond the relief of tears. She had built herself a castle of hopes, and it had not been a castle in Spain, but a structure well on the probable side of the Pyrenees. There had been a solid foundation on which to build. Miss de Fry's fortune was an assured and unhampered one. Her liking for Comus had been an obvious fact, his courtship of her a serious reality. The young people had been much together in public, and their names had naturally been coupled in the matchmaking gossip of the day. The only serious shadow cast over the scene had been the persistent presence, in foreground or background, of Courtney Ugel. And now the shadow suddenly stood forth as the reality, and the castle of hopes was a ruin, a hideous mortification of dust and debris, with the skeleton outlines of its chambers still standing to make mockery of its discomfited architect. The daily anxiety about Comus and his extravagant ways and intractable disposition had been gradually lulled by the prospect of his making an advantageous marriage, which would have transferred him from a ne'er-do-well, an adventurer, into a wealthy idler. So not only does she not get what she wants, but the problem that she hoped to kill two birds with one stone, but now she has two problems thrown right back in her lap. He might even have been molded by the resourceful influence of an ambitious wife into a man with some definite purpose in life. The prospect had vanished with cruel suddenness, and the anxieties were crowding back again. More insistent than ever, the boy had had his one good chance in the matrimonial market and missed it. If he were to transfer his attentions to some other well-dowered girl, he would be marked down at once as a fortune hunter, and that would constitute a heavy handicap to the most plausible of wooers. His liking for Elaine had evidently been genuine in its way, though perhaps it would have been rash to read any deeper sentiment into it. But even with the spur of his own inclination to assist him, he had failed to win the prize that had seemed so temptingly within his reach. And in the dashing of his prospects, Francesca saw the threatening of her own. The old anxiety as to her precarious tenure of her present quarters put on again all its familiar terrors. One day, she foresaw, in the horribly near future, George St. Michael would come pattering up her stairs with the breathless intelligence that Emmeline Chetroff was going to marry somebody or other in the Guards or the Record Office, as the case might be, and then there would be an uprooting of her life from its home and haven in the Blue Street, and a wandering forth to some cheap, unhappy, far-off dwelling where the stately Vandermeulen and its companion host of beautiful and desirable things would be stuffed and stowed away in soulless surroundings, like a courtly emigre fallen on evil days. It was unthinkable, but the trouble was that it had to be thought about. And if Comus had played his cards well and transformed himself from an encumbrance into a son with wealth at his command, the tragedy which she saw looming in front of her might have been avoided, or at the worst, whittled down to easily bearable proportions. With money behind one, the problem of where to live approaches more nearly to the simple question of where do you wish to live, and a rich daughter-in-law would surely have seen to it that she did not have to leave her square mile of Mecca to go out into the wilderness of bricks and mortar. If the house in Blue Street could not have been compounded, I think there may be a word missing. I've noticed two typos in the last two pages, which is unusual for this volume. They screwed up one page where they flat misprinted a half page of an earlier story, but there were very few typos through extremely close type text of 460 pages. But I think there's something missing here. But anyway, you'll get the sense. If the house in Blue Street, that's where she's living currently, could not have been compounded, something's missing, for there were other desirable residences which would have been capable of consoling Francesca for her lost Eden. So, point is, even if Emmeline eventually married someone and kicked her out, if her son had married this rich young woman, she could have been comfortably and appropriately rehoused in the same basic area, the life she's become accustomed to, as they say. And now, the detested Courtenay Youghal, with his mocking eyes and air of youthful cynicism, had stepped in and overthrown these golden hopes and plans whose non-fulfillment would make such a world of change in her future. Assuredly, she had reason to feel bitter against that young man, and she was not disposed to take a very lenient view of Comus's own mismanagement of the affair. Her greeting when he at last arrived was not couched in a sympathetic strain. "So you've lost your chance with the heiress," she remarked abruptly. "Yes," said Comus coolly. "Courtenay Youghal has added her to his other successes." "And you have added her to your other failures," pursued Francesca relentlessly. Her temper had been tried that day beyond ordinary limits. "I thought you seemed getting along so well with her," she continued, as Comus remained uncommunicative. "And you have added her to your other failures," pursued Francesca relentlessly. "I thought you'd been getting along so well with her," she continued, as Comus remained uncommunicative. "We hit it off rather well together," said Comus, and added with deliberate bluntness, "I suppose she got rather sick at my borrowing money from her. She thought it was all I was after."
"You borrowed money from her?" said Francesca. "You were fool enough to borrow money from a girl who is favorably disposed towards you, and with Courtney Ugel in the background waiting to step in and oust you?"
True English attitude toward money. And also the true attitude, a woman seeing it how another woman would see how her son acted. "My son's a freaking idiot."
"You borrowed money from her?" said Francesca. "You were fool enough to borrow money from a girl who was favorably disposed towards you, and with Courtney Ugel in the background waiting to step in and oust you? Are you insane?"
Now, you know he wouldn't write, "Are you insane?" And you know she wouldn't say that.
Francesca's voice trembled with misery and rage. This great stroke of good luck that had seemed about to fall into their laps had been thrust aside by an act or series of wanton, paltry folly. So you're throwing away an inheritance of 100,000 pounds a year for two pounds, that you can waste gambling or buying liquor, whatever. You are pathetic, is what she's thinking.
The good ship had been lost for the sake of the traditional hapworth of tar, halfpennyworth, half a pennyworth of tar. Comus had paid some pressing tailor's or tobacconist bill with a loan unwillingly put at his disposal by the girl he was courting, and had flung away his chances of securing a wealthy and in every way desirable bride. Elaine de Frey and her fortune might have been the making of Comus, but he had hurried in as usual to effect his own undoing. Calmness did not, in this case, come with reflection. The more Francesca thought about the matter, the more exasperated she grew. Comus threw himself down in a low chair and watched her without a trace of embarrassment or concern at her mortification.
Maybe she ought to go out and find a man herself, you know.
He had come to her feeling rather sorry for himself and bitterly conscious of his defeat, and she had met him with a taunt and without the least hint of sympathy. He determined that she should be tantalized with the knowledge of how small and stupid a thing had stood between the realization and ruin of her hopes for him.
"And to think she should be captured by Courtney Ugel," said Francesca bitterly. "I've always deplored your intimacy with that young man."
"It's hardly my intimacy with him that's made Elaine accept him," said Comus. Francesca realized the futility of further upbraiding. Through the tears of vexation that stood in her eyes, she looked across at the handsome boy who sat opposite her, mocking at his own misfortune, perversely indifferent to his folly, seemingly almost indifferent to its consequences. Remember, women value safety and security above all else. So they don't understand men, and men generally don't understand them. But Saki sure as hell does understand women. He really doesn't even write about men that much, actually. We can say after 500 out of 600 pages, or almost, or 460 anyway. It's like men are only used to set off what women are actually like in his stories, I think I would say. And I think I need to say here that although it might seem, you know, we hear how patriarchy, and people would say, oh yeah, there's a big patriarchy back then. The Victorian middle class thing was going decades before he ever wrote, where the woman is morally pure, and the woman's on a pedestal, and the woman is this heroic, noble, saintly creature of much higher values and morals than crude, gross, beastly man is. So he was writing against that in some sense. Now, of course, it wasn't 100th as terrible it is now, but it was still something to, it must have been something back then even to criticize women and write what they're really like. Not these wonderful, elevated, angelic creatures. Francesca realized the futility of further upbraiding. Through the tears of vexation that stood in her eyes, she looked across at the handsome boy who sat opposite her, mocking at his own misfortune, perversely indifferent to his folly, seemingly almost indifferent to its consequences.
"Comus," she said quietly and wearily, "you are an exact reversal of the legend of Pandora's box. You have all the charm and advantages that a boy could want to help him on in the world, and behind it all there is a fatal, damning gift of utter hopelessness."
"I think," said Comus, that is the best description that anyone has ever given of me."
"Basically that all his gifts are wasted."
For the moment, there was a flush of sympathy and something like outspoken affection between mother and son. They seemed very much alone in the world just now, and in the general overturn of hopes and plans, there flickered a chance that each might stretch out a hand to the other and summon back to their lives an old dead love that was the best and strongest feeling either of them had known. But the sting of disappointment was too keen, and the flood of resentment mounted too high on either side to allow the chance more than a moment in which to flicker away into nothingness. The old fatal topic of estrangement came to the fore, the question of immediate ways and means, and mother and son faced themselves again as antagonists on a well-disputed field. So they got their own personal World War I going on.
"What is done is done," said Francesca with a movement of tragic impatience that belied the philosophy of her words. "There is nothing to be gained by crying over spilt milk. There is the present and the future to be thought about, though. One can't go on indefinitely as a tenant for life in a fool's paradise." Then she pulled herself together and proceeded to deliver an ultimatum which the force of circumstances no longer permitted her to hold in reserve.
"It's not much use talking to you about money, as I know from long experience, but I can only tell you this, that in the middle of the season I'm already obliged to be thinking of leaving town, and you, I'm afraid, will have to be thinking of leaving England at equally short notice. Henry told me the other day that he can get you something out in West Africa. You've had your chance of doing something better for yourself from the financial point of view, and you've thrown it away for the sake of borrowing a little ready money for your luxuries. So now you must take what you can get. The pay won't be very good at first, but living is not dear out there," dear meaning expensive.
So he lost on the girl, but he gained a chance to go to West Africa.
You haven't lost it, daughter. You've gained a whole teeming shitload of bully-bullies.
Okay, let's see.
"West Africa," said Comus reflectively. "It's sort of a modern substitute for the old-fashioned oubliette, which is a prison cell in the floor, of all things. A convenient depository for tiresome people. Dear Uncle Henry may talk lugubriously about the burden of empire, but he evidently recognizes its uses as a refuse consumer."
"My dear Comus, you're talking to the West Africa of yesterday, while you have been wasting your time at school, and worse than wasting your time in the West End, other people have been grappling with the study of tropical diseases, and the West African coast economy is being rapidly transformed from a lethal chamber into a sanatorium."
Comus laughed mockingly. "What a beautiful bit of persuasive prose. Reminds one of the Psalms, and even more of a company prospectus. If you were honest, you'd confess that you lifted it straight out of a rubber or railway promotion scheme. Seriously, Mother, if I must grub about for a living, why can't I do it in England? I could go into a brewery, for instance."
Francesca shook her head decisively. She could foresee the sort of steady work Comus was likely to accomplish with the lodestone of town and the minor attractions of race meetings and similar festivities always beckoning him to him from a conveniently attainable distance. But apart from that aspect of the case, there was a financial obstacle in the way of his obtaining any employment at home. Breweries and all those sorts of things necessitate money to start with. One has to pay premiums or invest capital in the undertaking and so forth. And as we have no money available and can scarcely pay our debts as it is,
It's no use thinking about it.
Can't we sell something? Asked Comus.
He made no actual suggestion as to what should be sacrificed, but he was looking straight at the Vandermeulen.
For a moment, Francesca, she's going to want to take a bat to him at this point. For a moment, Francesca felt a stifling sensation of weakness as though her heart was going to stop beating. Then she sat forward in her chair and spoke with energy, almost fierceness.
When I am dead, my things can be sold and dispersed. As long as I am alive, I prefer to keep them by me.
In her holy place, with all her treasured possessions around her, this dreadful suggestion had been made. Some of her cherished household gods, souvenirs and keepsakes from past days, would, perhaps, not have fetched a very considerable sum in the auction room. Others had a distinct value of their own, but to her, they were all precious. And the Vandermeulen, at which Comus had looked with impious, appraising eyes, was the most sacred of them all. When Francesca had been away from her town residence or had been confined to her bedroom through illness, the great picture with its stately, solemn representation of a long-ago battle scene, painted to flatter the flattery-loving soul of a warrior king who was dignified, even in his campaigns, this was the first thing she visited on her return to town or convalescence. If an alarm of fire had been raised, it would have been the first thing for whose safety she would have troubled. And Comus had almost suggested that it should be parted with, as one sold railway shares and other soulless things. Scolding, she had long ago realized, was a useless waste of time and energy where Comus was concerned. But this evening she unloosed her tongue for the mere relief that it gave to her surcharged feelings. He sat listening without comment, although she purposely let fall remarks that she hoped might sting him into self-defense or protest. So he's very good. He knows how to handle himself. Either just listen and watch with cool eyes or agree and amplify. Oh, no, I'm even worse than that. Come on, you're not giving it enough.
It was an unsparing indictment, the more damaging in that it was so irrefutably true, the more tragic in that it came from perhaps the one person in the world whose opinion he had ever cared for. And he sat through it as silent and seemingly unmoved as though she had been rehearsing a speech for some drawing room comedy. When she had had her say, his method of retort was not the soft answer that turneth away wrath, but the inconsequent one that shelves it. Let's go and dress for dinner. The meal, like so many that Francesca and Comus had eaten in each other's company of late, was a silent one. Now that the full bearings of the disaster had been discussed in all its aspects, there was nothing more to be said. Any attempt at ignoring the situation and passing on to less controversial topics would have been a mockery and a pretense which neither of them would have troubled to sustain. So the meal went forward with its dragged-out, dreary intimacy of two people who were separated by a gulf of bitterness. I like that. Two people separated by a gulf of bitterness. And notice how I said, I like that. Like the character in Charlie Varick. He says, Charlie Varick, last of the independents. I like that. There's a ring of finality. Which also fits here too, doesn't it? Francesca felt a sense of relief when she was able to give the maid the order to serve her coffee upstairs. Comus had a sullen scowl on his face, but he looked up as she rose to leave the room and gave his half-mocking little laugh.
You needn't look so tragic, he said. You're going to have your own way. I'll go out to that West African hole.
So I guess that's maybe the one thing he could do for his mother. Although he already burned her with even the idea that he might sell her cherished goods. But, you know, then there you go. I mean, I don't know if you look at it however you want to look at it, but that ends chapter 12. And there's only one way to look at that. And I think there's about maybe four more chapters left, four or five. I think there's maybe 17 total, so maybe five left. And maybe we'll do two, and then the last three is one unit, whatever makes sense. But anyway, it's getting quite a tale. It's great and it's sad, I think. It's drama, right? It's a dramatic conflict. Well, anyway, thanks for being with me. I've been Alex Linder reading to you from Saki's short novel. Some might call it a novella. I'm not sure the term novella even existed. It came into time in a very specifically, I believe. Well, who did the first novel? A lot of people would say it was Cervantes and Don Quixote. I think I recall that from English class. First novella, I don't know. I would say something that's... I would say a short story could go up to maybe 50 pages, but if it's 50 to 100 pages, I would call that a novella. And if it's over 100, then maybe 125, then you get into a serious novel. But 90 pages, to me, that's about the definition of a novella. So I would call this a novella, though the book calls it just plain a novel. Maybe don't care about such small matters, but to me, they're quite interesting. Anyway, thanks for listening to me. This has been The Unbearable Bassington by Saki, pen name of Hector Human Rowe. Find all the matters that we record as part of our Learning College at vnnforum.com, as you should know by now. I'll be back with you again real soon.